Hello, listener. You are tuned in to Stems and Leaves, a podcast where we explore intersectional stories in STEM. Each episode, I invite a new guest on to discuss their work in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and beyond, and how their identities have shaped the work they do. My guest for this episode is Shauna. Hi, Shauna.
Hello.
So Shauna and I met a few weeks ago at a meetup for Association for Women in Science and 500 Women Scientists. So it was a really great event. Women in the DMV area all got together and we were just chatting about our work and making some good friendships. And Sean and I really hit it off. We were talking about medicinal plants for a good, like, hour.
Yeah, I think so.
It was really great, and I learned a bit about Shauna and her career, and I was really excited to sit down and discuss more with you. So first of all, let's get started with this episode with our identities. So would you share your name, your pronouns, and kind of what identities are important to you and impact the work you do?
Sure. So my name's Shauna. My pronouns are she, hers. The identities that are sort of salient to me are I am queer. I sometimes identify specifically as bisexual, but I find that the category queer has a nice level of ambiguity and vagueness that makes me feel more comfortable. I am Jewish. I am a white Jew. And I wouldn't say that my whiteness is something that I am in any way proud of, but it is certainly salient to me, and I try to see it as not just like a default. So Jewish, queer, I in the past have struggled with mental health issues, which is a perspective that I sometimes, you know, try to bring to my work and sometimes try to forget about entirely.
Yeah, definitely.
So those are sort of like the ones I can think of.
Thank you for sharing those. I wonder if you would expand a little bit on using sort of the umbrella term queer.
Well, for me, I don't 100% feel as if I belong with any of the other categories. I think for some queer folks, an individual category, like, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual, pansexual, like, you have that feeling of, like, recognition, or this captures me, or this gets my essence. And for me, I've just not felt, like, confident that the specifically, like, I have at times in my life been like, maybe I'm just a lesbian. And also at times been like, maybe I'm just straight. Given that, I'm like, okay, probably bisexual is it. But yeah. Like, I don't know, maybe there's like a level of like asexuality or aromantic, or I think the terminology is more around like demisexuality or demiromantic. But it's just like, for a while I was like pinging back and forth between these things and not feeling comfortable in any of them. And then, so I just decided, you know what, queer captures all of it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what I am, but I'm something in this area, so I'll just say queer.
Yeah. You work as a freelance coder. You have your own company?
Yes.
You want to plug it?
It's called Galaxy Rise Consulting. I do technology consulting. So it really covers a whole lot of different stuff, which is part of why I like it. It gives a real variety in the type of work I do. So sometimes I'm doing data analysis projects, or I'm coding up a website or a tool for a client. Sometimes they've already got something and I'm giving them technical advice about how to make it more easy to contribute to. I do a lot of work in the sort of open source area. And sort of that open source knowledge can be very helpful. But I've run workshops for clients. I have done technical interviewing for clients. I've done research. So it's sort of like
a little bit of everything. Yeah. So I guess, what is your favorite kind of stuff to work on?
That's tough. I think for me, there's certain areas that I like to work in. And then within that, there may be particular things I particularly enjoy doing. Like I enjoy coding. I enjoy data analysis and things that are sort of like experimental. And you have a hypothesis and you're checking like whether you're remotely on the ball on it. But, you know, I also like teaching. I also like writing. So for me, it's more the thing that really makes me happy in my work is when it's the goals of the project and the goals of the client and the space that it's in is aligned with my interests. So I'm particularly interested in the sciences and in the sort of political and civic impacts of technology. So especially when things are in that space, I get very like excited and happy to be working with a particular client.
Yeah. So I guess another question that I guess is the opposite of that and probably a little more personal. For stuff that isn't necessarily like your favorite thing to do, where do you find motivation as someone who's freelancing to like get the work done? Because I've tried doing some like freelance GIS work and freelance technical writing documentation. And when the fun stuff is there, it's like, oh, I can get through this in a couple hours. Like, just get it done.
Right.
And then there's things that drag a little bit and it's just like, and it's like, you're only accountable to yourself. So how do I guess maybe keep yourself accountable in your work?
Well, it does help that, as I've gotten more success, I've been able to be kind of picky in the clients that I take. So I largely don't have, I mean, I mostly don't have clients where I'm doing significant amounts of work for them, where I'm like, oh, yeah, this is kind of boring. And I don't like, and I don't, I no, I've never had a client where going into it, I was like, I actively dislike this work or I actively dislike the goals. So there hasn't been that sort of like, I mean, there've been times, where I've been like, years later, I've been like, like, would I take that client again? No, maybe not. But there's not that sort of like psychological block at the time. And I've always been pretty decent at making myself do stuff I don't want to do. And I have like all sorts of tricks for that. Like, you know, set a timer, work for X period of time, and then, you know, treat yourself to like, I don't know, like a drink or a nice cup of coffee.
Yeah, when a little self-bribery.
When I was in college, I had the junior mint method of writing papers, which was every time you write a sentence, you get a junior mint.
Yep, that's a great one. I like that a lot. So let's talk a little about your work history, because you have been freelance coding for how long now?
About 9 years.
Okay. And before that, you were in neuroscience.
Yes.
So I guess maybe do you want to take it back to even like undergrad and go from academia into that?
Sure, sure. So I went to Hampshire College for undergrad. And Hampshire College is great. It's a very non-traditional school that allows you to basically create your own majors. We call them concentrations instead of majors. And then you do essentially a very large senior thesis your final year. We call them div threes because we have to have separate terminology for everything. And so my focus when I was an undergrad was on a bunch of different things, but the main thing was on neuroendocrinology was my what I was focusing on my final year. And in particular, I was looking at sort of a, it was an amalgamation of social psychology and neuroendocrinology, because my interest in psychology has always been around social behavior. So why do people make the decisions we do about how we interact with others? Why do we feel the emotions we feel in response to the things that people do? And in particular, I've always been interested in moral behavior. So, but I've also, especially at this point in my life, I was like, oh, you know, social psychology, it's so fuzzy and soft. And if I measure a concrete thing about the body, then I'll be like looking at real hard, concrete things. So Hampshire is a small liberal arts college. We didn't have a ton of sort of like, we didn't have a ton of like concrete ways into looking at social psychology. We had an event-related potential lab, which I did some studies in, but this is a bit of a derail, but the way event-related potentials work is you're looking at EEG activity in the brain in a very short time period after a stimulus. So something on the order of like, I think 500 milliseconds max, maybe. And I was thinking about social behavior where it's kind of hard to come up with something where you could, people could do something meaningful in that 500 milliseconds. Like I did do some studies, but it was kind of hard to fit an experimental paradigm into that. So I wasn't that interested in doing an ERP study for my, my Div 3, my senior thesis. But there was an endocrinology lab. So what I ended up doing was looking at hormones that were associated in some way with moral behavior. So I did two studies, one by myself and one with an Amherst College student. And one was, I looked at helping behavior. So altruistic behavior, in this case, it was reading a story about, I believe it was kids in who are suffering in some way. This is like 15 years ago now. It was kids who were suffering in some way, and then people were invited to donate the money they were going to get for being in a study to a charity.
Interesting. Okay.
And there's some research at the time suggesting that stress responses to situations where people needed help had a somewhat paradoxical effect. Mm-hmm. So some research says if people are really stressed out by people who need help, they're more likely to help. And other research that says if people are really stressed out, they're actually more likely to leave the situation as quickly as possible. And if they can do that without helping and it takes longer to stay and help, they'll do that. So that was the sort of paradigm I was looking at.
And okay.
So I was getting spit samples from people and measuring cortisol levels, which is chronic stress, and epinephrine levels, which is acute stress. Mm-hmm. And then the other study was around the ultimatum game, which is a behavioral economics game where one person gets an amount of money to split, and the other person can either take it and then they get that amount of money, or they can say no and no one gets any money. And, you know, within cultures, people are all over the map, but culturally there do seem to be patterns where in some places fairness is rewarded culturally, so people are more likely to reject anything but an even split, and in other places there's not that sense of fairness. So they'll, you know, except if someone says, here, you get $1 and I get $9. Or even in some cases, I'm going to keep $10, you get $0. And people will be like, sure, I'll still accept it because, you know, at least someone's getting the money.
Yeah.
And so I was looking at that with testosterone levels and seeing whether testosterone increased the tendency to do, like, punishing behavior and rejection of unfair splits. So that was what I was doing in undergrad. After undergrad, I wanted to do neuroimaging, which is a very expensive process. But for me, that was like, I really just wanted to be looking at social psychology from a hard science perspective. Because I think at the time, I just felt like that was the way to get like real concrete, certain answers.
Yeah.
So for about 2.5 years after I graduated, I worked in neuroimaging labs. I worked at one in UC Davis that was looking at emotion processing in people with schizophrenia. And then I joined a lab called the Moral Cognition Lab in Boston. And that was looking specifically at moral decision making and having, so we literally just stick people in giant magnets and ask them questions like the trolley dilemma, or like, you know,
interesting,
is it okay for someone to like break into a window and steal like medication for their wife if they can't afford it and their wife is dying, which is, that's like one of the classic moral dilemmas. We didn't actually really ask that one because it's so classic that people have kind of heard about it, so we try to do other ones. But over the course of a couple years, as I was doing this research, I realized it wasn't the right path for me for a whole bunch of different reasons. One being that, you know, I like to do a bunch of different things and skip around and do a lot of interdisciplinary work and try a bunch of different things. And I was able to like focus long enough to do my senior thesis, but a PhD dissertation is like a whole like different
that's
level
different
of focus.
Beast.
I remember talking to a professor at the school I was working at, and I was like, I want to do these 5 different things, and she was like, you're gonna have to pick one, and I was like, no,
but I have 5 things I need to do them.
I need to do all 5. But another thing was that I think especially around the time that I was doing social neuro in the gym, I think as human beings, we like having certainty and we like feeling like the questions we ask have definitive answers. And that was part of what was pulling me to specifically do endocrinology research and neuroimaging research instead of what felt like the softness of just observing people do things and talking to them about it. But there's a lot of stuff that's just inherently messy. And going at it with a tool that seems hard just obscures the messiness, but it doesn't make your answers any better. It just makes you overconfident in your answers. And so that was something for me personally, but I think that was also a big part of the social neuroimaging field. And so as I was struggling through that, I didn't really have people to sort of be like, actually, there's a different way to approach this. And so in the end, I was just like, you know, I'm not going to stay in this field. It's just not working for me for a number of reasons. I had no idea what I wanted to do next. So I was like, let's be practical. What skills do I have that people will pay me to do? And I'll just do that for a while as I figure out where to go from here. And the real obvious thing was programming. So I had learned to use program primarily with MATLAB, which is what we use to do both stimulus presentation and data analysis at the neuroimaging lab. And I had a little bit of JavaScript at that point because we'd also started to do some web-based behavioral stuff. And I must stress at this point that I was really not a very good programmer. The way I had been taught was essentially there were other people in my labs who knew how to program at least a little bit more than me. They would give me scripts that already existed, and I would attempt to A, understand what the scripts were doing, and then B, adapt them to do the different thing that I wanted to do, which raised like a whole other level of concern with the work we were doing, because I remember definitely feeling overwhelmed at times where I would be like, so neuroimaging research, the research, like the methodology that's actually done is in fact very complicated statistics that I think a significant portion of people who are working on it just abstract away. They don't interface with that very much. Because basically you're looking at these three-dimensional images over the brain that are actually four-dimensional because they're also over time. And you're looking at, you know, unusual patterns of activity, but it's not just about the activity in any one, what's called a voxel, which is like a data point. It's about the pattern. So it's like these very complex images, and there's all been all sorts of like methodological, like fighting is a tough term, but like disagreement about like what kinds of methods are rigorous enough and which are not. And so I came into this without any real statistical background. I had taken a class in descriptive statistics, which was a perfectly nice class, but like almost completely irrelevant to the work I was doing. And I hadn't taken any, I had taken one programming class, which again was irrelevant to the work I was doing. I took like an intro computer science class at Hampshire that was about Java. And so I did learn like some basic things like what an if statement is or like what a while loop is. But also the Java type of programming is like very different from MATLAB, which is what I was using.
Very much so.
And so I felt completely over my head, which is bad for me as a researcher. But I was like, but you know, I do it, like I technically, I have these skills.
Yeah, so good for me as a person that loves a challenge.
And I tried to be very honest with people when they hired me early on. And it helped that most of my early clients were related to my neuroscience work in some way. So there was like a postdoc in the lab who was like, I don't know how to program at all, so please help me make MATLAB scripts. And I was like, well, I'm not very good at it, but I can at least do it. So like I worked with her. There's another another friend of mine was a grad student who needed someone to program like a user interface in MATLAB for his laser lab. And I was actually, I still have, when we were done, we were testing to see whether it worked. Laser cut a space invader onto a sheet of metal, and then he gave it to me. And he was like, "Here, you can take this home as like a memory of this."
What a
like,
good trophy!
I know, and I still have it because it's really cool. and I feel like a lot of my early clients just like fade into memory, but I'm always like, I see the little laser cut space invader, and I'm like, "Yeah, that was a fun job."
I love that.
But yeah, it's you know, so that was 9 years ago, and it's just very much been a growing process ever since. There, I got involved with the Python community, which was really, really helpful for me. So I just met some people socially through a community science organization called Sprout. And I ended up moving into a housing co-op. And one of the people there was, you know, very active in the Python community. So it was always very easy when I was working on stuff to be able to just be like, hey, this is like not working. What's wrong? And like talk through stuff. Boston, which is where I was at the time, also has a really vibrant community, a Python community, which is actually there's a reason why it's so vibrant, which is that around 2010, 11, 12, which was right around the time that I was moving into this, a woman named Jessica McKellar started a meetup workshop thing called Python Boston Python workshop for women and their friends. Mm-hmm. And the way that it works is that anyone who's a woman could come, and people who are not women could also come, but they have to come as a friend of a woman. Mm-hmm. And so the result of that was that it ended up being like usually at least like 75% women at these workshops. And it was mm-hmm. usually women who were teaching the workshops. And so they were very popular and very successful. Mm-hmm. Jessica's a great leader and organizer of this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And as part of this, like the sort of Boston Python as a community as a whole just kept growing because it was bringing in just like a ton of newcomers in a really friendly, positive way. Mm-hmm. So it's just a great place to pick up a language, a great community to help pick up a language. And that's what I've been specializing in ever since. And mm-hmm. Python's a very popular language in the sciences. Mm-hmm. So as well as in, I think, the civic community. I mean, one of the nice things about Python is that it does a lot of different things really well, and it's maybe not the best for any one particular task, but it's the second best at a lot of tasks.
Yeah.
So there's a huge scientific Python community, but it's also very frequently used in web development. Mm-hmm. And those are probably the two things I use the most. Mm-hmm. And because Python does both of those things well, mm-hmm. I can specialize and I don't have to learn two separate languages to do these things. So.
Yeah. I love Python.
Yeah.
I use it for a lot of my GIS work, for coding applets. I've used it for web development with like web apps. I've just like written Python codes for fun just to see what I can do with it. Mm-hmm. I love Python. So let's, as we're talking about your work, how have over the years, I guess, your identities impacted your work? And I think you're kind of a good case because you were in one very specific field for a while, and now you've been in a very, not polar opposite, but a totally different ballpark for 9 years now. So you had some good time in both, you know, environments. How, if at all, did your identities impact the work you did?
I mean, it's hard for me to say if slash how my identity impacted the neuroscience work I was doing, mm-hmm. Because I think that when I was doing that work, I was relatively unsophisticated in how I thought about my identity, mm-hmm. and I took a lot of things for granted. And I think that comes from having, in many ways, a lot of like default identity, like dominant identities. Mm-hmm. So I was able to sort of like ignore the fact that I had identities at all. Mm-hmm. Which is not to say I didn't think about being queer. I didn't think about being a woman. But I do think that, you know, depending on what the identity in question is and what the context in which you're operating is, sometimes things can be really, really salient and impossible to ignore. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can just like float along not being particularly critical about it, and mm-hmm. Which is not, it's not necessarily a bad thing as long as you're not hurting anybody else. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think all identity aspects of identity needs to be reflected on too much. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, I think, choice and context. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I have thought a lot about my identity as I've been working as a freelancer, mm-hmm. particularly in terms of not the specific clients I take on or the specific work I do, but the way that I build connections in the broader industry. Mm-hmm. So, which is, I think, a little bit more salient, like a little more important for me, or something I think more intentionally about than perhaps other people do who work at offices. Mm-hmm. Because when you work at offices, you, at least in theory, get a whole network of colleagues and people you know in the field just mm-hmm. through that.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're working for yourself, you have to be like, okay, who, like, how do I network? Who do mm-hmm. I talk to? And so for me, that's meetup groups, it's conferences. Those are the two main things. And then sometimes taking on additional projects with the people that I meet through those things. Mm-hmm. And like I mentioned, that the Boston Python Workshop for Women and Their Friends was an organization I've been a part of. One that was really helpful for me and now no longer exists, sadly, is Ada Camps. So these were run by the Ada Initiative, named after Ada Lovelace. Mm-hmm. It was active, I want to say, these give or take a year or two, it was active between like 2012 and 2015. Mm-hmm. But it was the sort of theme or purpose of it was to create social connections between people with marginalized identities, primarily like gender identities. So I think the term used was not cis men were mm-hmm. invited to come. And people in open source was like the other thing. So it was non-cis men in open source were invited to come to mm-hmm. Ada Camp. And it was really the attendees were really carefully selected. You had to apply and get accepted. Mm-hmm. And I just met a bunch of just really amazing people through that. Mm-hmm. People who are still like a key part of my network now. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really delightful experience. And I continue to try and create spaces like that to help spaces like that, the Pi Ladies that are mm-hmm. part of the Python ecosystem. I did a couple of workshops with Diverse Scholar, which is a project run by Alberto Roca, mm-hmm. and it's focused on raising information about open source and open science communities to at colleges and spaces that are primarily Latino or Black. Mm-hmm. So I haven't done a ton with Alberto lately, but I have tried to help as much as I can. Mm-hmm. And just generally trying to create spaces where, because my experience has been that there's something of a relief going into a space that's explicitly shaped around an identity, because you know that within that space, you're not going to have to worry about people being dismissive or aggressive around that identity, mm-hmm. which doesn't mean that in another space that's not explicitly around that, you will experience that. But, you know, I'm sure you've had the experience of just something coming at you out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a blessing to walk into a space and know, oh, I'm not going to have to explain my pronouns in this space.
Right.
Or when I get together with my friends, and my friend group is primarily people of color, I know I'm not going to meet friends of friends who are going to say, oh, you're so exotic. Where are you from? Minnesota. And especially for queer identities, over the past couple years, I've been working hard to find those spaces. Where I'm from, Columbus, it's a little more difficult. Mm-hmm. We are a very like queer-friendly city, but we're not a very science city. So, you know, there's like queer groups, groups for LGBTQ, and there's groups for scientists, but the overlap for them,
yeah, finding the overlap,
very, very narrow. And so when I came out here, I was like very much trying to find women scientists, women who code, other groups of that nature, and it's been very fun. And I very much appreciate hearing you speak as a person that in both women's spaces and in queer spaces has a level of privilege, being white, to hear you using your privilege to advocate and help create those safe spaces. So thank you for that. So freelancing just sounds like fun. Freelancing, and this is my assumption, is very isolating. Mm. And you've talked about having to be very diligent about creating your own community kind of from scratch through meetups, through conferences. How do you practice sort of self-care in a more isolated environment? Because I know for myself, like, I'm an introvert by nature, but if I don't get like a daily dose of people time, then I'm like talking to my cat, like making weirdness happen. what does self-care look like for you?
That's a tough question. I am historically not great at self-care. Mm-hmm. I feel like over the course of the last 9 years, I am constantly in this cycle where my work I'll go through periods where I'm like, no, at 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock every day is when I stop and I can't do anything work related past this period, and I don't work on weekends. And then that like slowly, those boundaries slowly disappear. Mm-hmm. And then I look up and I'm like, wait, I haven't taken a day off in weeks, so no. Mm-hmm. And then I like try to set the boundaries again. But one of the things that makes that tough is that, as I was saying, I do a lot of, meetup groups, community groups, things like 500 Women Scientists. And that stuff usually happens in evenings and weekends because people are doing it outside of their 9 to 5. And just because I could do it during my 9 to 5 doesn't mean that the vast majority of people can. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, right now I'm doing some organizing work with 500 Women Scientists. I'm co-organizing the DC chapter of the Tech Workers Coalition. I'm participating in a number of other sort of interest or identity groups. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly evenings and weekends. And mm-hmm. the answer to like how I do self-care is sometimes I forget.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a point. I mentioned earlier that I sometimes struggle with mental health issues. For me, that's primarily in the form of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that when I overload myself, I start just getting more anxious by default. And mm-hmm. so one of the things that's a sort of like something that sort of reminds me to step back and try to get those boundaries in place again is when I just am like, why am I so anxious? Like, there's nothing bad is happening. There's nothing to be anxious about, or whatever thing I'm anxious about is very minor, but I'm just having like a sort of like a default stress reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, maybe it's because I haven't taken a day off in a while.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's tough. It's tough. I believe very strongly in being intentional in how you create your life. And one of the things I try to do in my freelance work is to pick work that is meaningful, create space for personal projects that are meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the best case scenario for all of us, the work we do is profoundly connected to our values and our goals in life.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to manage that as best I can. But the downside of that is you can have a lot of pressure. Like,
yeah.
I, especially in like the current political climate,
mm-hmm.
And you shuffle things and you say, okay, I want to do this action. This action is really important. Politically, I can shuffle my life around. I'm not going to get fired if I, you know, skip out on work, you know, for this day to go to a protest. But then you still have to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, well, the thing that gets tossed out is like, you know, reading a book or like mm-hmm. relaxing with friends.
Mm-hmm.
So I try not to like always let the relaxing, fun break stuff fall to the bottom of the priorities list. But
mm-hmm.
It does a lot of the time. And mm-hmm. I only really prioritize bumping it up when I've reached a point where I'm like, no, this is really having a negative impact on me. I need to mm-hmm. bump it back up again.
Yeah. So you also have mentioned, like, in your self-care, working to help manage anxiety. Mental health isn't something that's come up on this show yet, as a focus of any of our discussions. Would you be comfortable chatting about this
a
little bit?
Yeah.
So I know as an undergrad myself, I very much struggle with anxiety and panic disorder. It sucks.
yeah, it does.
Because everything just feels like it's so high stakes, and if I make one bad move, I'll die. And I know that's, you know, figments of my imagination, and the, you know, default wiring in my brain is just, I am on survival mode all the time. So I'm sure you can relate to some of that. How have you talked about kind of managing it in this freelance space where you have a lot more control over your environment and who you're interacting with. So I guess kind of stepping back into your neuroscience days where research, high pressure, a lot of, you know, people wanting answers depending on you. How did you manage your mental health in those kind of situations?
Yeah, I mean,
or was it even a problem?
Well, I would say that I think that overall, the sort of broad arc of my experience has been that it's gotten easier to handle my mental health over time as I've just had different experiences and learned from them.
Mm-hmm.
So probably the time when I most struggled with mental health was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically was pretty severely depressed and I stopped going to school. Turns out I ended up not ever graduating. Which was fine because, like I said, I went to like a hippie, non-traditional school, mm-hmm. and they were like, why didn't you graduate? And I was like,
didn't want to. Like,
essentially, like, with a little bit more ranting about the educational system and its, like, constricting, like, mm-hmm. demands, and how my, like, you know, U.S. history teacher was, like, feeding me, like, you know, critiques of all the mm-hmm. things that I was being taught in Hampshire. It was like, okay, yes, you're not doing well, and it's because the system you're in doesn't work for you.
Mm-hmm.
That was the point at which my mental health issues most impeded with my functioning,
mm-hmm.
because I was essentially just like not doing anything during that time period.
Mm-hmm.
I was skipping school and I would go to the local Barnes & Noble and I would read all day. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't doing nothing. I was like reading,
mm-hmm.
But it was very much escapism. And I knew that like eventually people were going to find out that I was skipping school, but I was just like, not, I was like, you know what? I do not have the capacity to think about the future. I am just going to go and read all day, mm-hmm. and something will happen eventually. Mm-hmm. And what happened eventually was that, you know, people finally found out about it. I've been hiding it from my parents. My parents found out about it. They were like, let's, why don't you see a psychiatrist? And we worked out a plan to get me to graduate, but it didn't end up happening, but it was fine because at that point, Hampshire had already accepted me. Mm-hmm. And so I have struggled with both depression and anxiety since then, but, over time I've learned things from like mundane things like exercise. It's really like regularly exercising has basically removed, I mean, knock on wood, but like, for the last several years since I've been exercising regularly, I have not particularly struggled with depression and just with anxiety. So it seems mm-hmm. like exercise really helps me sort of like avoid the low lows mm-hmm. and keep going. And the sort of like practical impact is that it feels like the anxiety is more present, but it's just that where before I would get like so overwhelmed by anxiety, just fall into depression. Now mm-hmm. I just seem to have these energy reserves from possibly from the exercising. I don't mm-hmm. know. Or maybe not. You never know. It's an N of one. It could be, there are plenty of confounds. And like various other things. I've been working really hard on, you know, identifying unnecessarily critical thoughts, mm-hmm. Trying to see when I'm feeling anxious about something, what elements are things that I can control and what elements are things that I cannot control, mm-hmm. and learning to understand when I'm searching for certainty and control in a place that I'm just not going to be able to get it. Mm-hmm. And the healthiest way forward is just to accept that there's ambiguity and uncertainty mm-hmm. and risk to all of life.
Yeah.
And I do feel as though this sort of very intensely personal process does inform the way I do my work and the way I approach my work, because a lot of the work I do is either research-based or it's in the sort of sphere of managing technology, like not just building it, but thinking about the impacts of how you build it, both individual pieces of technology that I consult with clients on, but also some of the volunteer work I do in sort of political and societal impacts of technology. Mm-hmm. And it feels to me that there's a lot of fear in this space right now. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people on all sides want there to be clear answers. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people who are building tools up until recently were able to just sort of ignore all of the uncertainty and all the risk involved. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that is a very human desire to avoid uncertainty and risk. Mm-hmm. But it's also the privilege to be able to avoid uncertainty and risk. And I think, I don't know, I feel like I'm jumping around a little bit here, but I think that there's a similar dynamic between saying to someone who's building technology, look, it's going to have impacts on the world that you're not going to be able to control, and there's nothing you can do that's going to give you 100% control, but you can increase the chances that you won't hurt someone by being in community and connection and listening to the people who are impacted by it. I think there's something similar there to some of the stuff that I've been struggling with as a white person trying to understand systemic racism and issues around that, where, you know, it makes me very uncomfortable to hear about things, to watch racism happen, whether it's through following something on Twitter or in my real life, mm-hmm. And sort of being like, okay, it's uncomfortable, it's uncertain, it's risky, it's ambiguous, it's stressful. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that there's anything that I can do that'll make those feelings go away. Mm-hmm. I have to learn to just have those feelings and figure out collectively with everyone involved what the best thing I can do is mm-hmm. to make it better for everyone, with the understanding that there's no perfect.
Yeah.
But life is long. I mean, it's short, but it's also long. And just because you have a hard time getting into that good headspace today doesn't mean that tomorrow you're not going to be able to. So mm-hmm.
these have been some very good thoughts. We are almost to an hour of recording. So I think we can, this feels like a bit of a downer to wrap up on. No, it was helpful. It's diametric thinking, just being aware of both sides. So I think we're going to call it where we're at. Shauna, thank you so much for joining me to chat on the show. If you, listener, are interested in the work that Shauna does, links to her website will be down in the description. And a couple of the other organizations we've mentioned, there will also be links provided. AWIS, 500 Women Scientists, the Python groups that you mentioned. We'll share those with you down below. Tune in next episode for another guest and another great story. This has been Stems and Leaves. I'm Emmy Montreiti. Thank you for listening.